Senator Tower, the United States now has a military presence someplace in Central America. It has armed Marines in Lebanon. Sometime today, we'll have AWACS planes and fighters over Chad. On two levels, sir, philosophically and militarily, should we have this presence all over the world? How many places can we intervene?
Yes, I think that we should maintain an American presence over the world. We have to understand the Soviets now have a considerable capability for force projection throughout the world, acting very often through surrogate states such as Cuba. And therefore, it behooves us, if we are to protect our vital interests and support our foreign policy objectives, to maintain this American presence. Now, I might say that we will not have AWACS aircraft or fighter aircraft over Chad. They will be in the vicinity.
From CBS News, Washington, Face the Nation on the CBS Radio Network. A spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with Senator John Tower, Republican of Texas, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senator Tower will be questioned by CBS News congressional correspondent Phil Jones, by CBS News Pentagon correspondent David Martin, and by the moderator, CBS News correspondent George Herman. We shall resume the interview in a moment, but first, here is George Herman.
John Goodwin Tower was born in Houston, Texas on the 29th of September, 1925, and that means that in about a month and a half, he'll be 58 years old. His father was a straight-laced Methodist minister, and young John Tower went to Beaumont High School and then into that alternative form of education, military service in World War II. He served on an amphibious gunboat in the Western Pacific. His Navy service ran from 1943 to 1946, Tower ending up as a chief petty officer. Then he went back to school to get his degrees, a Bachelor of Arts from Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas, a master's degree in political science from Southern Methodist, and then graduate work at the London School of Economics and Political Science. In his spare time along the way, Tower worked for a local radio station and then became a faculty member teaching political science at Midwestern University. Tower's political career began early, and as is usual in such matters, it began unsuccessfully. He ran for the state legislature in 1954 and lost. Then 6 years later, state Republican leaders selected him to make a sacrificial run against Senate Majority Leader and Democratic vice presidential candidate Lyndon Johnson. Tower won 41% of the vote and lost again, but he found himself in such a good position that when Johnson left the Senate for the vice presidency in 1961, Tower won his seat handily. He won again in 1966 and 1972, but in 1978 he suffered a narrow escape against Democratic Congressman Robert Krueger. Tower now has had 22 years in the United States Senate and has risen steadily in power and influence. He concentrates mostly on defense and military issues. He had wanted to be Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan and nearly got that job, but that would have endangered his Senate seat needed to maintain the small Republican majority in that chamber. So Tower stayed on in the Senate and made the Armed Services Committee a powerful force behind the president's leadership. Tower is married and has three children.
And now we continue with Face the Nation.
Senator Tower, you talked about having military forces all over the world to balance the Soviet spread of military forces. Do we have the capability to go to as many places and balance as many forces as the Soviet have fingers in pies around the world?
I would say that right now our capability needs substantial enhancement. That's why we're building the 600-ship Navy, because the Navy is always the cutting edge of a force projection capability. So we are trying to build to that capability. Right now, for example, we can only use one Marine amphibious force. We don't have the sea lift and the support capability of deploying, say, two Marine amphibious forces. That's a Marine division plus all of its augmentation. And we do need to improve that capability because we're challenged in various parts of the world, and we do need to have greater flexibility without having to draw down on our resources that are needed in such parts of the world where we have interlocking alliances, such as in the Mediterranean, the Atlantic, Western Europe.
Senator, how far do you think the United States should go in attempting to save the government of Chad from these Libyan-backed rebels now attempting to overthrow it? We've already sent the AWACS aircraft. What if that is not enough? What if the rebels continue to advance?
Well, I think that we should provide all the logistical support possible. I don't believe that an incursion or I should say the insertion of American troops is indicated. To begin with, Chad is a landlocked country, and it's not tied to any sea line of communication. And I would not anticipate that we would do that. Let me note that already the Organization of American States is supportive of Chad in its effort to maintain its independence.
American States or African States?
Organization of African States, I beg your pardon. And, for example, there are troops from Zaire there now. We would expect that any kind of troop support would come from other African states, not from the United States.
But, Senator, aren't you concerned that the United States is getting involved too deeply in another civil war?
Well, what we're trying to do is not involve ourselves in a civil war, but to prevent the intrusion into that war of Colonel Gaddafi, who is, of course, very hostile to the United States and hostile to our interests. We have to look at Chad now in terms of its relationship to other African countries. It's very geographically placed, just below the Sahara and right into the heart of Central Africa. And Africa is enormously important to the United States as a source of raw materials and as a potential marketplace.
Well, then how far should we go in this?
Well, I don't think that you ought to speculate on how far you should go. I think it has to be identified as a vital interest to the United States. And I think that we should use reasonable prudence in what we do, but I don't think that we should announce in advance the limits to which we will go. I think it should be understood that the United States is committed to the protection of its vital interests abroad. We, after all, don't want to find ourselves more or less isolated in this world from important sources of raw materials.
Are you concerned at all about the issue of legitimacy? For example, the side that we are supporting, that of President Hissène Habré, is a government which took over and forced out the previous president, whose name was Gukuni Wede, as I recall. So that we are really supporting rebels or insurgents or revolutionaries against what was a legitimate government.
Well, the fact is, that is the recognized government of Chad. It is the government that's accredited to various capitals throughout the world. It is the government that is recognized by the Organization of African States.
But it's a civil war. Should we really be taking sides in it?
But the point is, not involvement in a civil war, but trying to prevent the intrusion of others into a civil war and turning it to their own uses. Don't think Colonel Gaddafi has any great philosophic notions about who should be in charge in Chad. Colonel Gaddafi would like to be the dominant influence in Chad. And the implications for other African states and the implications for the United States and Western Europe and our interests there
are
very
ominous
indeed.
Are we prepared to do this all over?
But I think that we should do it where we can respond. And if we say that we will not do it, then that's saying that we are going to leave a power vacuum here, and we cordially invite the Soviet Union and its surrogates to rush in and fill that vacuum. That is not in our national interest.
Senator, perhaps
we're not doing this for altruistic reasons. We're doing it because of perceptions of national interest.
Could you clarify for us exactly what the AWACS have been sent to Africa to do?
Well, the function of the AWACS aircraft is simply to acquire targets, so to speak. That is to say, it monitors movements in the air and can determine where aircraft are coming from.
For whom are we acquiring these targets?
Going.
For whom are we acquiring these
well,
targets?
Well, obviously, I would envision the AWACS in this role as a warning aircraft, that is to say, to warn the people on the ground in Chad of the approach of an attack. That's that function, so that they can be ready for it with their own air defense capability.
Senator, do you think Congress should have any say in what's going on? Going back to George's opening question about us having people here, there, and yonder, and the President and the Pentagon are deciding these things. Should Congress have any say?
Well, I think that Congress does have a say. After all, we authorize such things as the Rapid Deployment Force. And,
but currently, the money that is being sent to help the forces
well, I
in
think
Chad
is
coming
very
from
great
a fund
danger.
That Congress doesn't have
any. There's a very great danger in Congress narrowly proscribing what a president can do. I think we have to look at it in this terms. Historically and traditionally, up until the decade of the 70s, the president, had the primary function responsibility of formulating foreign policy and of implementing it. And we had a very good, strong congressional bipartisan support for the president. We got into the Vietnam War, and then Congress tried to institutionalize some of its disagreements with the president or some of its own revulsion at our involvement in Vietnam through various restrictive acts. But the fact is, the president must have some degree of authority and flexibility in the formulation and implementation of foreign policy that would not be appropriate or admissible in terms of internal or domestic affairs. And you have to remember, too, that domestic legislation is made by different members of Congress representing different regions, different interest groups, and it's a product of shifting coalitions.
Isn't that true in the administration, too?
You can't formulate foreign policy on that basis. Congress doesn't negotiate. Only the president has the knowledge, the intelligence, the president or his subordinates,
but isn't that
to engage in negotiation. Well, can you imagine 535 members of Congress going out and trying to negotiate and maintaining any kind of comprehensive foreign policy? Remember, too, that the president is elected by all of the people, and it is a necessary concomitant of nationality.
The executive branch
formulates foreign policy. Only the executive branch can negotiate. Only the executive branch can deal with confidentiality with other nations. Now, if you try to involve Congress too much into the act, your foreign policy is going to be a shambles. There'll be no continuity to it. And I think we have to admit that however well motivated some of my colleagues very well may be, that a lot of their votes on foreign policy issues are dictated more by domestic political considerations than clear perceptions of national interest.
Isn't there a faint hint of this in this inside the administration, too? You seem to have several power sources inside the administration.
You
have Ambassador Kirkpatrick.
This is going to be true in any administration. But the administration has a greater capability to deal with those shades of disagreement between and among its own functionaries than the Congress has to deal with a broad spectrum of different ideas on foreign policy issues.
No administration
has ever formulated a perfect foreign policy. But certainly it is probably better than anything the Congress might attempt to formulate based on the fact that Congress is made up of shifting coalitions and based on the fact that regional and domestic political interests have more of an influence on the Congress than clear perceptions of national
interests. Senator, you are chairman of a very powerful committee in Congress, Armed Services Committee in the Senate. Doesn't it start to bother you as one member to pick up the paper or turn on the news and find out that the administration has this big operation going off the coast of Central America, that we have AWACS planes going to get in the vicinity of Chad, and that you are not consulted in any way? You're just told after the fact?
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm not consulted. I think that usually there's a heads-up given to certain key members of Congress that have responsibility in certain areas. And I feel, quite frankly, that I have been adequately consulted. I believe I would be more disturbed if there was no American reaction, if we were prepared to let those people who are hostile to the interests of the United States do what they will in this world without any challenge by the United States.
Senator, back in 1975, you were the ranking Republican member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which investigated the Kennedy administration's covert war against Cuba. And I think everyone would agree now that that war was pretty much of a disaster. I think even former members of the Kennedy administration, like McGeorge Bundy, have said as much. All we succeeded in doing really was solidifying Castro's hold on power and causing our own government considerable embarrassment with things like the Bay of Pigs. Are we about to embark, or are we embarked on a similar venture with the covert war that is now going on against Nicaragua?
I don't think so. To begin with, it's difficult to measure the times when covert action has been successful in the preservation of American interest, because we don't talk about covert action. I think, in fact, the investigation by the Church Committee, of which I was the vice chairman, probably was very harmful because it revealed too much of sources and methods, how we operate, and inhibited us too much in carrying on covert operations. Now, let's understand what we're up against. The KGB, the Russian counterpart to the CIA. It's really the Russian counterpart to the CIA, the FBI, the National Security Agency, and all of these things. And it maintains a much larger network all over the world than we do. We don't maintain clandestine infrastructures in virtually every third world country, but the Soviets do. And they are very well organized, well disciplined, and too often well financed, well armed. And they have a potential for making a great deal of trouble. We have to have some covert action capability to counter this enormous threat that's posed to our interests in various parts of the world.
Senator, you talked a while ago about the inability of the Congress to do various things which are properly the province of the administration. But I've been trying to ask you, and I will now ask you, are you satisfied with the unity and course of action of the administration in all these matters? For example, let me just call a few items to your attention. Judge Clark told Republicans on the Hill that these exercises off Nicaragua had been planned since February. The Pentagon tells us that they were caught by surprise by these things and had to scurry to find enough units to put it together and couldn't put it together as fast as the administration wanted. Ambassador Kirkpatrick didn't hear about it until a reporter asked her about it, and then she expressed some surprise. Is the administration really pulling together and doing this thing skillfully?
Let me say that the administration is quite capable of making mistakes and has made mistakes. As I say, previous administrations have also made mistakes in the implementation of foreign policy decisions.
I'm just asking for your evaluation.
But that doesn't argue against still permitting the administration a great deal of flexibility in the conduct of foreign policy. Too many cooks can really spoil the broth there.
I'm just asking your evaluation.
And, you know, we could go through an entire historic recitation that only goes back 15 years of the mistakes that Congress has made in intruding itself too much into the decision-making process.
I'm just asking for your judgment.
Oh, I would say that there's probably much you can criticize the administration from. At the same time, that doesn't argue for Congress preempting the foreign policy formulation responsibility of the administration.
Senator, has the time come for the president to declare publicly that he will commit American troops to Central America if necessary to stop the flow of arms from Nicaragua and Cuba?
I don't think you make commitments like that. You don't telegraph your punch when you're considering the use of military means to implement an external policy decision.
Senator Goldwater,
you keep the opposition
right
guessing, and I think that's part of the deterrent value. Now, every time we worry about involvement, we should remember the times when we have established an American presence and foreclosed a crisis that might have occurred, that might have resulted in greater involvement later on. The idea is to demonstrate a willingness to use the power that you have to reduce the likelihood that you will have to use it. That's what's called deterrence.
Senator, the Pentagon says that Soviet bloc arms shipments to Nicaragua are proceeding at about twice the rate of last year. If that trend were to continue, would you favor implementing either a quarantine or a blockade of Nicaragua?
I'm not going to second-guess what kind of decision should be made in that instance. Again, this is an issue that should be taken by the president, by the executive branch, with whatever congressional authorization approval as may be required. I think that is one of the options that you consider. There are a number of options that you can consider using in these instances, but I don't think it's responsible to talk about publicly what those options are and which ones you're likely to use. Again, the uncertainty is, in fact, an element of deterrence, in my view.
Well, let me ask the question another way. The U.S. has one carrier task force now off the coast of Central America. It has a battleship en route, has another carrier battle group en route. What if all of these ships show up and the rate of Soviet bloc arms shipments continues and we do nothing other than simply monitor them as they go into port in Nicaragua? What kind of signal does that send? That's certainly not a signal of deterrence, is it?
Well, I'm not suggesting that it necessarily is, but you're asking me to speculate on something that hasn't happened yet. I think we deal with the situation as it occurs. I personally, and this is my own personal opinion, would not shrink from a naval blockade if it's indicated. I don't think it's necessarily indicated. What you might do by your presence there is be able to provide enough intelligence to the indigenous forces that they can affect the interdiction themselves, and that's the most desirable way to go.
Isn't this all a little reminiscent of John Foster Dulles saying you have to walk to the brink? You have to let the world know that you're ready to commit troops if you really are going to prevent troops from having to go in?
Well, I don't think that the term brinkmanship is necessarily applicable. The question is, how far do you permit the other side to go? Adlai Stevenson used to talk about the ultimate door. If we permit them to open so many doors and enter them, at what point do they open the ultimate door and we have to mount massive resistance against them? So I think that what you do is try to anticipate these crises before they occur. Have some facility for crisis management to the extent that you can defer those crises and you don't have to walk to the brink.
But crises is a difficult word. I mean, all Americans above a certain age who've brought up reading O. Henry short stories or who've read, as you have, political science and have taught political science, know that everywhere in South America, governments have come and gone, and the new one has never been better or longer lasting than the old one. And here we are putting ourselves on the line, our reputation, our men's lives, if necessary, for governments that we have no confidence in.
Ah, but we have to understand that it's not just for the benefit of these governments. It's not just for altruistic reasons that we're there. We're there because we consider it to be in our national interest, because a hostile presence in this hemisphere could be threatening the United States.
Yes, but can we have confidence in the new government?
Let's go back to the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine was established not just because we were trying to preserve the territorial and political independence of the newly emerging states of Latin America, but because we believed that a European presence in this hemisphere was inimical to our own national security interest. So this is what we have to think in terms of. I wouldn't advise our getting involved in the internal affairs of any country, or even bothering to worry about an internal revolution, except when that is likely to be exploited from without by countries like the Soviet Union, whose interests are hostile to those of the United States. And then I think prudence dictates that we have to act in our own national interest.
Well, Senator,
for how long?
Well, as long as it takes.
But I mean, every Latin American country has a revolution every so many years.
Well, what is going to
net
us to say we will do nothing? We will shrink from this. We will not become involved. Isn't that an open invitation for them again to rush into a power vacuum which we've created? I think that it is. And historically, it's indicated that that's what they will do. Remember Dean Acheson's declaration back in the late 40s that South Korea was outside our sphere of interest.
Oh, that was the Joint Chiefs declaration.
Yes, but it was reinforced by Dean Acheson.
Well, he quoted
and he later, of course, recanted
when
it became necessary for us to intervene, or we at least felt it became necessary for us to intervene. So when you make assertions like that, you have to consider what the ultimate consequences might be.
Senator, you have defended the administration's actions on everything here today. Every place they are, they ought to be. We've got to have this presence. You've talked over and over about it. Doesn't it bother you when you talk about the need for this presence because the Russians are doing all this thing? They're making us come out and put our forces here, there, and yonder. Doesn't it bother you that at the same time we have a plan to sell grain to the Soviet Union?
It doesn't bother me to the extent that we can sell them the grain, and I don't think that substantially enhances their war-fighting capability. Now, I believe if we're going to impose an embargo on the Soviet Union, it should be a total embargo. There are a lot of things they're getting from us by direct or indirect means that are of much greater value to them than the grain. They can buy the grain from Argentina or Canada or Australia. In the absence of some sort of grain OPEC, you're not going to stop the flow of grain in the
Soviet Union. Well, is there mischief?
Anyway, but the thing that worries me most is the Soviet Union acquiring Western technology, which does vastly enhance their warfighting capability.
So
as Admiral Watkins said, it appears that we're competing against ourselves because they're taking American technology, some of which they can get in newspapers, magazines, and that sort of thing, some of which they buy or steal or purloin or is transferred to them by third parties, and incorporate that into weapon systems much more quickly than we can.
Should we try an embargo?
I wouldn't recommend an embargo at this point. And I believe that we ought to maintain lines of communication with the Soviet Union, because I think that we should try to negotiate reduction of tensions, reductions of arsenals and destabilizing arms, and I don't believe in completely shutting off lines of communications with the Soviets.
Senator, how does the Reagan administration go about trying to form some sort of political consensus on this, on our policy towards Central America? You support it, but I think most polls show
that
it is not.
Well, I think that the Reagan administration is really pursuing a course that has fairly long been established in the United States ever since World War II, a bipartisan fundamental foreign policy that was worked out in the Congress by Vandenberg and Connally, Democrats and Republicans, and has been the hallmark of American foreign policy up until the Vietnam War, when congressional consensus tended to disintegrate over an enormously unpopular war. It's unfortunate that we're still inhibited by the Vietnam syndrome.
I guess on that unpleasant note, we have to conclude. Thank you very much, Senator Tower, for being our guest on Face the Nation.